Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Samuel chapter 2. I'm going to do the first 26 verses, not the entire chapter. We'll entitle this section of scripture, The Song of Hannah and Eli's Worthless Sons. We'll go from the sublime to the ridiculous. Our context is this. In the first chapter of 1 Samuel, we looked at the birth of Samuel and his dedication to the temple service by his mother Hannah. She's just done that at the end of chapter 1, so now we begin in chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. Then Hannah prayed and said, My heart exults in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth speaks boldly against my enemies, because I rejoice in your salvation. There is no one holy like the Lord. Indeed, there is no one besides you, nor is there any rock like our God. Boast no more so very proudly. Do not let arrogance come out of your mouth, for the Lord is a God of knowledge, and with him actions are weighed. Now this prayer of Hannah, some people say it's a prophecy, it was a song. You could call it the Song of Hannah or the Prayer of Hannah. And if you want to go further than that, you could call it a prophecy. As Adam Clark says, quote, the Chaldee very properly says, and Hannah prayed in the spirit of prophecy. That's another translation. For indeed the whole of this prayer, or as it may probably be properly called oracular declaration, is a piece of regular prophecy, every part of it having respect to the future, and perhaps not a little of it, declaratory of the Messiah's kingdom. Now that's kind of interesting as we go through here to look at this as a prophecy. I've got a good quote here that Adam Clark has, quoting a Dr. Hales, a commentator of his generation. Let's read what Dr. Hale says, quote, Hannah was also a prophetess of the first class, besides predicting her own fruitfulness, 1 Samuel 2 through 5, for she bore 6 children in all. We'll see that in just a minute. She foretold not only the more immediate judgments of God upon the Philistines during her son's administration, 1 Samuel 2, but his remoter judgments upon the ends of the earth, 1 Samuel 2:10, in the true spirit of the prophecies of Jacob, Balaam, and Moses. Like them, she describes the promised Savior of the world as a king before there was any king in Israel. And she first applied to him the remarkable epithet Messiah in Hebrew, Christ in Greek, and anointed in English. An anointed king, Hannah talks about. Hales is basically saying. Hales continues, which was adopted by the term anointed, or the Messiah, or Christ. It was adopted by David, Nathan, Ethan, Isaiah, Daniel, and the succeeding prophets of the Old Testament, and by the apostles-inspired writers of the New. So that's a big deal. Hannah is using the word anointed for the first time, the word Messiah for the first time. And the allusion thereto by Zacharias, the father of the Baptist, John the Baptist, in his hymn, Luke 1:69, where he calls Christ a horn of salvation. Hannah does the same thing, or she mentions a horn of salvation. Hales continues, and the beautiful imitation of it by the Blessed Virgin throughout in her hymn. In other words, Mary's Magnificat parallels Hannah or reflects Hannah's wording. All of this clearly proves that Hannah in her rejoicing had respect to something higher than Peninnah, her rival, or to the triumphs of Samuel, or even of David himself. The expressions are too magnificent and sublime to be confined to such objects. Indeed, the learned rabbi, David Kimchi, was so struck with them that he ingenuously confessed that the king of whom Hannah speaks is the Messiah, of whom she spoke either by prophecy or tradition. For, continues he, there was a tradition among the Israelites that a great king should arise in Israel, and she seals up her song with celebrating this king who was to deliver them from their enemies. The tradition, as we've seen, was founded principally on Balaam's second and third prophecies. If you look back at Balaam's prophecy, he talked about a star coming that's going to wipe out the enemies, referring to the Messiah. And we cannot but admire that gracious dispensation of spiritual gifts to Hannah, whose name signifies grace, in ranking her among the prophets who should first unfold a leading title of the blessed seed of the woman. Well, now that's a pretty awesome quotation, I think. That puts Hannah's song here up at a very, very high level, on the level of the greatest prophets of the Old Testament. So we'll be looking for some messianic implications as we go through this song. Now, when was the prayer composed, or the prayer of Hannah, the Song of Hannah, composed? Well, it could have been at the dedication of Samuel, which is what it sounds like. That was happened right there at the end of chapter 1, and here we go to chapter 2, so the song would then follow on chapter 1 chronologically. Could have been several years earlier at the birth of Samuel, when Anna wrote the song. We don't know. Now let's look at verse 1, where Hannah says, "My heart exults in the Lord, my horn is exalted in the Lord." Now horn, of course, is the standard symbol of strength, because the strength of a bull is in his horn. That's where you don't want to get hit. But now Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown has got an interesting speculation as to what horn means. "My horn is lifted up." Quote, "Allusion is here made to a peculiarity in the dress of Eastern women about Lebanon, which seems to have obtained anciently among the Israelite women, that of wearing a tin or silver horn on the forehead, on which their veil is suspended. Wives, who have no children, wear it projecting in an oblique direction, while those who become mothers forthwith raise it a few inches higher, inclining towards the perpendicular, and by this slight but observable change in their headdress make known, wherever they go, the maternal character which they now bear." So if Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown is right about that, when Hannah says, "My horn is exalted," she's saying, "The horn that holds my veil up has been lifted up, exalted, and so that proves that I'm pregnant." Well, that's interesting. I doubt very seriously it's true, but it's very interesting. Now she says in verse 1, "My horn is exalted. I rejoice in your salvation." Whenever you see salvation, you have to think, is this temporal salvation? Is it spiritual salvation, or is it both? Well, if it's temporal salvation, that means she was, quote-unquote, saved from the reproach of barrenness. She was saved by having that baby, Samuel. I tend to just not worry about that too much and say, when I see salvation, just include both. Why not? God temporally saves us, and he eternally saves us. He physically saves us, and he spiritually saves us. Now, in verse 3, Hannah says, "Boast no more so very proudly. Do not let arrogance come out of your mouth." Now, who is she talking about there? Most probably Peninnah, her sister wife, Elkanah, her husband's other wife, who every festival would taunt Hannah and say, "Ha, ha, ha, I've got a child and you don't." And so she's saying, "Don't let any more arrogance come out of your mouth, Peninnah. I got you now, because I've got a son." Hannah says in verse 3, "The Lord is a God of knowledge, and with him actions are weighed. God knows what you did, Peninnah, and he weighed your actions and your taunting, and this is what happened. He's balanced the scales of justice." We go now to verses 4 through 6 of 1 Samuel 2. "The bows of the mighty are shattered," Hannah continues, "but the feeble girdle in strength. Those who were full hire themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry cease to hunger. Even the barren gives birth to seven, but she who has many children languishes." Another little slap at Peninnah. "The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to Sheol and raises up." Sheol, of course, meaning the place of the dead. So here we have basically Hannah saying, do good guys win and the bad guys lose when God executes his justice? There's that Hebrew literary style of contrast. The bows are shattered, the feeble have strength. Those who were full, now they're so hungry they got to sell themselves out in order to make bread, in order just to eat bread. But those who will hunger don't hunger anymore. See the contrast there. The barren gives birth to seven. Now seven there, you could say Hannah is predicting that she's going to have seven children, but there are only six that are mentioned. We will see that in verses 20 and 21 when we get there. She had Samuel, then she had three sons and two daughters for a total of six. And so you could say, well, Hannah is predicting she's going to eventually have seven, but it doesn't say so. So it could be that she's just using the number seven to stand for many. Proverbs 24:16, "For a righteous man falls seven times and rises again, but the wicked stumble in time of calamity." How about Peter? How many times shall I forgive somebody, Lord? Seven times or 70 times? And Jesus said 70 times seven. Seven was the number to the Hebrews what eight is to the Chinese. In China, it's a lucky number. In Israel, it was a sacred number. And so she is just basically saying the barren is going to give birth to a lot of kids. I think that's what that means. I don't think we should take it literally. But Hannah, again, she's sticking it to Peninnah. And she who has many children, that would be Peninnah, languishes. Seems to me that she's engaged in a little bit of schadenfreude here, that famous word that everybody likes to use these days, gloating over your enemy's defeat. Sounds like it, but I don't disrespect her for that. I tend to take it as justice because, you know, you ought not to gloat over somebody and make fun of them. It's disgusting. Peninnah got exactly what she deserves in this song. The Lord kills and the Lord makes alive. That's referring to different groups of people. He kills the bad guys and he makes alive the good guys. Kind of a military reference there. We go to 1 Samuel 2, verses 7 through 10. Hannah continues, the Lord makes poor and rich. Again, he makes the bad guys poor. He makes the good guys rich. He brings low, that's the bad guys. He also exalts, that's the good guys. He raises the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with nobles and inherit a seat of honor. God always does things backwards. The meek shall inherit the earth, the big shots. And I have done a lot of reading of kings, ancient kings, medieval kings of England, and I'm working on medieval kings of France. And all I can say is I would not want to be a king of England or France or anywhere, because their lives always were lives of strife, fear of assassination, fear of military defeat, gluttony, debauchery. I mean, how many, you can't even keep up with all the illegitimate kids these kings have, and they usually die in miserable circumstances. But Jesus takes the poor of the world and lifts them high. At the end of verse 80, why does he do that? For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's. In other words, the pillars, the things that hold up the earth, just like the pillars of a temple hold up a temple, well, God holds up the earth. And if God can hold up the earth, by golly, he can exalt the poor and the weak. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and he, the Lord, set the world on them, set the world on the world's pillars. He keeps the feet of his godly ones, but the wicked ones are silenced in darkness. For not by might shall a man prevail. And these are great verses to contemplate on and meditate upon when there are so many evil people in the world that are in charge. I think all the years I spent in communist China, I said, God, these guys have got so much power. They brainwash the people. They treat them horribly. They treat them like slaves. And then I come back to America and it's getting to be about the same way over here. Can't walk into a restaurant without a card that the Gestapo biomedical fascist, the biofascist require you to show before you can go into a restaurant. And I think, well, how long is this nonsense going to go on? And you wonder, but you got to remember, God made the world. He set the world on his pillars. He can take care of these people. He can silence the wicked ones in darkness. For not by might shall a man prevail. Well, the Chinese government or the American government can have might all they want, but they're not going to prevail in their desires for domination and control. They will not prevail. Those who contend with the Lord will be shattered. They will be shattered. Against them he will thunder in the heavens. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth, and he will give strength to his king and will exalt the horn of his anointed. And thus ends the song of Hannah. We see in verse 7, the Lord makes poor and rich and so forth, that the Lord is in control of the vicissitudes of life. When I think about that, I think about some big Wall Street tycoon. He was a multi-millionaire. I forgot his name. And then the 1929 crash occurred. He went back to his hometown in the Midwest and ran a bowling alley. That just caught me. He spent the rest of his life running a bowling alley after he was one of America's top tycoons and financiers. That's a vicissitude, folks. God's in control of all that. He makes high. He makes the poor high and the high low. Now, what does the average secular person believe controls riches and poverty and the vicissitudes of life? Luck. It's all luck. Or maybe hard work thrown in there too. If I work hard, I'll get rich. No, it's God that's in control of all that. Now in verse 10, Hannah says, those who contend with the Lord will be shattered. Now if this is a prophecy, she could have been prophetically thinking of Samuel as the one doing the shattering, because Samuel is going to fight with those who contend the Lord and shatter them, namely the Philistines. We'll see that in 1 Samuel 7, first 17 verses. Let me read you one of those verses, 1 Samuel 7:13. So the Philistines were subdued, and they did not come any more within the border of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. So she could be predicting what her little boy is going to end up doing, shattering the nasty Philistines. Now, the last line of the Song of Hannah, he will give strength to his king and will exalt the horn of his anointed. There's that word anointed. That's Messiah in Hebrew, Christ in Greek, anointed in English. Of course, when a king is anointed, that means he is recognized as king and oil is anointed or smeared on his head. And so Hannah here is saying that God will exalt the horn, the strength of God's anointed. Well, who is God's anointed? Well, if those previous quotes from Adam Clark that I just read are correct, then Anna is predicting the exaltation of Jesus the Messiah. Some people say, no, she's exalting the horn of Saul, the King Saul, or David. In other words, she's exalting, in the case of David, she's exalting the type rather than the antitype, Jesus. I don't think so. Adam Clark and Jameson Fawcett Brown say that this is talking about Jesus. She's predicting Jesus. Jameson Fawcett Brown says this is the first place in Scripture where the word anointed Messiah occurs. And those commentators go on to say, quote, as there was no king in Israel at the time, it seems the best interpretation to refer it to Christ. I think that's the best interpretation. It's not a slam dunk, but I think that's the best way to go. I've already mentioned the resemblance between Hannah and the Song of Mary, the Magnificat in Luke 1:46. We read, and Mary said, my soul exalts the Lord. Well, here Hannah says, God will exalt his anointed. Somewhat similar. I mean, it doesn't track completely, 100%, but it does give you that flavor. We go now to 1 Samuel chapter 2, verses 11 through 14. Elkanah went home to Ramah, that's Ramah Zophim, Samuel's birthplace and the place he's buried, about, if BibleAtlas.org map is right, about 15 miles to the west of Shiloh. So Elkanah went home there. But the boy served the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest. Now this, again, I think is going back to the end of chapter 1, where Samuel is first delivered to Eli. Hannah explains to Eli how she'd been praying, and that this was the answer to the prayer that she had made. And here he is, and Eli says, wonderful. And he takes the boy into service. So Samuel served the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest. Eli's sons were wicked men, we continue. They had no regard for the Lord or for the priest's share of the sacrifices from the people. When any man offered a sacrifice, the priest's servant would come with a three-pronged meat fork while the meat was boiling and plunge it into the container or kettle or cauldron or cooking pot. The priest would claim for himself whatever the meat fork brought up. This is the way they treated all the Israelites who came there to Shiloh. Well, in verse 11, Samuel served the Lord. How could a little boy serve in the temple? Well, he could read out of the book of the law. He could learn to sing praises to God. He could learn to play an instrument like cymbals. He could light the lights of the tent of meeting, light the candles. He could open and shut the doors of the tent of meeting. So there were lots of things that a young boy could do. Now we go to the wicked sons of Eli. Holman Christian Study Bible calls them wicked men. The KJV calls them sons of Belial, sons of the devil. And the NASB translates it as worthless men. Adam Clark says they were perverse, wicked, profligate men, devil's children. Sounds about right. Well, here's the first thing that they did wrong. This revolves sacrificing, and we just need to, I'm going to summarize this real quick. The sacrifice involved is a peace offering, because in a peace offering, the offeror shared in the meat with the priest. And the way it worked is they would slaughter the animal. The Levite might slaughter the animal, or the offeror might slaughter the animal, and the fat portions would go on the altar first for God. Those were his portions. The breast and the right foreleg would go to the priest. So then the priest would take the breast and wave it before the altar, which I assume is left, right, up, back. And then the right foreleg was given to the priest, and he would heave that one, which is up and down. That, again, is debated, but that's the way I look at it. They would go through that ritual of dedicating these portions, saying, this belongs to you, Lord. And so the priest would take those parts as part of their service, as part of their pay, if you will, for doing all the priestly service, and they would have meat, and all the rest of the food would be eaten by the offerer and his family, and I think sometimes the priest might share in that meal too. But that's basically how a peace offering worked. Well, I'm going to summarize real quick here what happened. The priest, after the animal had been cut up, the fat had been offered, or actually, well, I tell you what, I need to read the whole everything that they did wrong. So I'm going to go ahead and keep going here and see what else the priest did wrong in verses 15 through 17. Also, before they, that's the priest, burned the fat, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, give the priest meat for roasting, as he will not take boiled meat from you, only raw. If the man said to him, they must surely burn the fat first and then take as much as you desire, then he would say, no, but you shall give it to me now, and if not, I will take it by force. Thus the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for the men despised the offering of the Lord. So this is what happened. The fat was supposed to be offered first, but instead of that, the servants of the priest would say, no, give us the fat now, along with all the raw animal before you have a chance to cook it. They liked the raw meat better than boiled meat. So they were doing two things wrong. They were taking God's portion, the fat belonged to God, and they were taking it for themselves. And then, at some point, they were stabbing with a fork into the offerer's portions that was boiling. They would pull up all kinds of meat, not just the breast and the right foreleg, but the offerer's portion too. That was one thing they did wrong, but sometimes they would even do worse than that. Before they would start boiling, they'd say, forget the boiling stuff. Give me the raw meat, the priest's portion and the offerer's portion. The right foreleg, the breast, that's ours, but also the rest of it. Give it to us raw. We don't like it boiled. And by the way, that means we get the fat too. So they were stealing the offerer's portion of the sacrifice, and they were stealing God's portion. Bad business. And for their actions, the sons were called worthless sons of Belial, perverse, wicked, profligate men, devil's children. Well, you say, well, that's a little strange just because they took a little extra meat. Well, remember, this is God's sacrifice. You recall what happened to Nadab and Abihu, Aaron's oldest sons, when they offered, as the King James put it, strange fire. And fire came out of the tabernacle and toasted them, sent them to an early grave. No, sir, this is serious business when you mess with God's sacrifice, God's sacrificial system. And that's what these people were doing, these priests, Hophni and Phinehas. Now, it says they had no regard for the Lord or for the priest's share. Now, this didn't mean that they were atheists. Oh, I'm sure they believed that God was out there somewhere, but they denied him by the works of their life. They had no love for or fear of God. They departed from the legal ways of worship. So whether they were atheists or not doesn't matter. It reminds me of Christian people today. I believe God, and you go out and fornicate with whatever comes to hand, animal, man, or beast. So they were evil. Now, the sacrifice that they were abusing, as I said, was a peace offering. It can't be a burnt offering because a burnt offering was totally consumed, assuming they were doing that right. And a sin offering was eaten by the priest, and so there wouldn't be any stealing from the offerer, as is mentioned in these several verses. So it was a peace offering. We go now to verses 15, 16, and 17 in 1 Samuel 2. Also, before they burned the fat, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, give the priest meat for roasting, as he will not take boiled meat from you, only raw. Now, I've already mentioned this. This is when they went beyond just stabbing the boiling meat. They went and said, I'll just forget the boiling. Just go ahead and give us the whole thing. If the man said to him, they must surely burn the fat first and then take as much as you desire, then he would say, no, but you shall give it to me now. This is the servant talking to the offerer. And if not, I will take it by force. Thus the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for the men despised the offering of the Lord. Again, the Levitical laws, Leviticus chapter 7, says that the fat goes to the Lord first before anybody eats anything. But now the priests are asking for the meat first before God. And of course, when the servant said, give the priest meat for roasting, the priest's servant says, give the priest, that's Hophni and Phinehas, meat for roasting. He's talking about meat from the offerer's portion, not the portion that Hophni and Phinehas legally had access to. Now, why would they ask for raw meat instead of boiled meat? Well, option number one, the obvious option, the priest liked roast meat better than boiled, as I do. That makes a lot of sense. Oh, there's nothing better than roast beef or roast sheep, roast lamb. Oh, reminds me of roast lamb in Xinjiang in the western part of China. They ate that morning, noon, and night. Oh, my gosh, roast lamb, it was wonderful. I can still taste it. And that's probably why they wanted it. Or it could be they changed their mind. They started out with just sticking a three-pronged hook into the boiling meat, and they'd pull up meat that was not, they couldn't see what they were getting, and they'd pull it up, and it was not the best parts of the animal. And so they said, forget the boiling, just give us the raw meat from the beginning so we can get what we want. Now the offerer, who's being oppressed by these servants, they were willing to give up their piece of the meat, but not God's part. They said, oh, no, 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 you got to burn the fat first. Well, at least they had some decency, the offerers. Colin Delitzsch says that taking the meat first before the fat was offered was the worst crime the sons of Eli committed. It really doesn't register on us how bad this was. We're going to see a little bit later that the priest was shacking up with women in the doorway of the temple. Now, that does seem bad, but this meat thing, because we're not into the sacrifices like the Old Testament Jews were. But it was the worst crime. It was a bad crime because God had set it up. He set it up for a reason. He set up all his Levitical laws for a reason, which is mainly to show separation and from the world and obedience to God, holiness. That was the whole theme of the book of Leviticus, is holiness. And these people were not acting holy. Now, verse 17 says, the sin of the young men was very great. Who were the young men? A couple of options here, three options. Option number one, they were the offerors that were sinning. They were getting robbed, and they were allowing it. Option number two, the priest Hophni and Phinehas despised their offering because they treated it with contempt. Or option number three, it's the servants of Hophni and Phinehas, whose sin was very great. Those were the people that were just talking about telling the offerors, you don't give us the fat, we're going to take it from you. That was the immediate context, and in fact, the Holman Christian Study Bible translates it that way. 1 Samuel 2:17, so the servant's sin was very severe in the presence of the Lord, not just the young men, but the servant's sin. So they assume it's the servant's sin. I think that's probably right. At any rate, there were plenty of people there working in the temple to be Samuel's role models, and boy, Samuel's role models weren't too good, were they? We go now to 1 Samuel 2, verses 18 through 21. Now Samuel was ministering before the Lord as a boy wearing a linen ephod, and his mother would make him a little robe and bring it to him from year to year when she would come up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, may the Lord give you children from this woman in place of the one she dedicated to the Lord. And they went to their own home, back to Ramathaim Zophim. The Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and gave birth to three sons and two daughters. And the boy Samuel grew before the Lord. Now we see once again in verse 18, Samuel was ministering before the Lord. He was also mentioned before the discussion of Phinehas' and Hophni's sinful service, his service to the Lord. Why was his childhood service mentioned before and after? To shame Phinehas and Hophni by contrast, perhaps? To honor Samuel by showing he was not corrupted by his corrupt environment? Maybe that's a literary reason why the author did that, but at any rate, we see Samuel, he's holding to the truth, surrounded by corruption. Oh, what a good application point to today's world. Corruption everywhere. Corruption in the elementary schools, the junior middle schools, the high schools, the colleges, the media, the sports world, corporations, and last but not least, the government. Corruption, filth, nastiness, stupidity, ignorance, blasphemy. It's everywhere. Well, Samuel was surrounded by stuff like that, and he managed to hold to the truth. Maybe we can too. Now in verse 18, Samuel is said to be ministering before the Lord, before Yahweh. In 1 Samuel 2:11, he was shown to be ministering before Eli. And some people say, well, that shows that he is now engaged in higher services. Before, he was helping Eli out, but now he's helping God directly. Well, that might be a little bit of a stretch. He was wearing an ephod. He wore an ephod all the time. Now, an ephod is somebody has described it as a small shoulder garment or apron. I like to think of it as a vest that was worn on top of the tunic or the robe that the priest wore. This was a high priest. This is what the high priest wore. Now, this Samuel was not a priest. He was a Levite, and he certainly wasn't the high priest. But he wore a little ephod, and so Eli is peculiarly honoring Samuel. Why does Eli honor Samuel above his own sons, Hophni and Phinehas? Was it because of Hannah's heartfelt prayer and Samuel's providential birth? The birth was indirectly foretold by Eli when he saw Hannah praying to herself, moving her lips, and he thought she was drunk. And then she said, no, I'm praying that God would answer my prayer. And Eli said, yes, well, God will answer your prayer. He didn't know what the prayer was, but he foretold that the prayer would be answered, whatever it was, and it was. And so when he heard the whole story, he says, okay, that's pretty cool. I'm going to honor Samuel more than my own sons. It could be he gave Samuel an ephod to wear all the time because Samuel was a perpetual Nazarite, which again is sort of a special deal. Now, the law required that the high priest wear an ephod. That's not the same thing as saying nobody else may wear an ephod. It's just that the high priest must wear one. So we're not going to say that Samuel was breaking the law here. Now, that ephod was perhaps brought by Hannah and given to Samuel, and then he just kept wearing it after his mama was gone. Or it could be Eli supplied the ephod. We don't know. But we do know that Samuel's mother, Hannah, brought him a little robe from year to year, once a year. Apparently she brought it, then she carried it back home, let him wear it again. It's not seeing Samuel, her own son, very much, once a year. It's interesting that that word, little robe, the Hebrew word that's translated that way, is the same word that is used to describe the priest robe in Exodus 28:4. These are the garments that they must make, a breastpiece, an ephod, a robe, a specially woven tunic. So the robe that went under the ephod, Samuel is made to be dressed up just like a little priest, a high priest even, but Samuel was not a priest. Well, Hannah did that. She did it why? To show her great love for Samuel. Maybe she wanted to lessen the expense for Eli or the congregation in maintaining Samuel, whatever. But I think it's mainly because she thought a lot of her boy Samuel. Now, it says in verse 19, she came at the time of the yearly sacrifice to bring the little robe to Samuel. She probably came to all three yearly sacrifices. She wasn't required to, being a woman, but she probably wanted to see Samuel. So three times a year, she got to see her boy. Not a lot, but it's better than being totally divorced from seeing him. And then every time that they showed up, Hannah and Elkanah, to see their boy, of course, Elkanah's there too, not just Hannah, Eli would bless the two and say, "May the Lord give you children for this woman in place of the one that you gave me." And that happened, as we'll see in a minute. There are five other children that are going to be born to Hannah. So Hannah gave one child to the Lord and received back multifold. We go now to 1 Samuel 2, verses 22 through 24. Now Eli was very old. He heard about everything his sons were doing to all Israel and how they were sleeping with the women who served at the entrance to the tent of meeting. He said to them, "Why are you doing these things? I have heard about your evil actions from all these people. No, my sons, the report I hear from the Lord's people is not good." The Lord's people, that would be the Israelites. How old was Eli? Gill speculates he was probably about 90 years old because he died when he was 98. We see that in 1 Samuel 4:15. Now, Eli was 98 years old and his eyes were set so that he could not see, as the book talks about the death of Eli. Now, why was it mentioned here that Eli was very old? What's the big deal about that? Well, it was mentioned to show Eli's incapacity for oversight of the tent of meeting. It explains Eli's half-hearted rebuke of his sons when he found out what they were doing. If he had been in the vigorous prime of life, he probably would have said, "Hophni and Phinehas, I'm going to kick your sorry, worthless rear ends out, not only of this temple, but out of Shiloh. Go away. I never want to see you again." But he didn't do that. He was old. If he had tried to exercise authority, Hophni and Phinehas would probably have laughed at him. However, many people say, and I probably agree with that, he really should have fulfilled his priestly duties. He did have the authority to throw his sons out of the priesthood. He was the high priest. And remember, this was a patriarchal society. You disobey your father, bad things happen in a patriarchal society. So Eli could have done something about it. So the old age, his old age, was a mitigating factor. It's not really an excuse. Apparently, Eli was too fond of his family's perquisites, but he was not fond enough of God's holy requirements. I have the priesthood in my family, and I don't want to damage my family's reputation by kicking my sons out. I don't want to cause a family stink. Well, how many times have people been hung by that, sticking up for your family instead of what's right? Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about this matter. Quote, "From fear or indolence, he," that's Eli, "shrank from laying on them the restraints or subjecting them to the discipline their gross delinquencies called for. In his judicial capacity, he winked at their flagrant acts of maladministration and suffered them to make reckless encroachments on the Constitution, by which the most serious injuries were inflicted both on the rights of the people and the laws of God." Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, of course, are talking like Scottish people, part of the British Empire. When they talk about the Constitution, laws and rights of people, that's sort of an anachronistic way of looking at it. But what they're saying is, Eli should have done something about this. Now, in verse 22, the sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were sleeping with women at the entrance to the tent of meeting. Now, that could have meant at the women's apartments that were built around some kind of a wood structure that was built around the tabernacle, around the tent of meeting, because, you know, sleeping at the doorway in the open there where everybody could see them. I don't think they were doing that. John Gill points out that Phinehas and Hophni were married men sleeping with women at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Man, these guys should run for office. If they were living today, they could run for office. Like old pencil neck Eric Stalwell sleeping with a Chinese spy, honored with a chairman as a chairman of a congressional committee. Now, who are these women that served at the entrance of the tent of meeting? They're obviously fairly loose in their sexual morals. Well, what were they doing? Well, they could be washing and cleaning all of the vessels and such that had to be done, or cloth that had to be cleaned. They could be fasting and praying. Fasting and praying while they're sleeping with the high priest's son. That's an interesting option. Jameson Fawcett Brown says this, quote, "An institution of holy women of a strictly ascetic order who had relinquished worldly cares and devoted themselves to the Lord, an institution which continued down to the time of Christ." Jameson Fawcett Brown referred to Anna, the famous Anna in the temple precincts, Luke 2:37, and then as a widow to the age of 84, she never left the temple, serving night and day with fastings and prayers. So Anna was serving at the temple, and so this is what Jameson Fawcett Brown suggests that these serving women were. Well, now, it seems that it would be strange that such women would be sleeping with the priest. They weren't forcibly raped. It doesn't say that, so they must have consented. Well, you might say that the religious authority of the priesthood cowed them. I don't believe that. They were doing it because they wanted to do it. Some people speculate that these women serving at the doorways were new mothers who brought their offerings for purification. You recall that new babies, when they were born, the mother had to get purified Levitically, ritually, and so they had to bring an offering to do that, and that's what they were there for. Well, all I could say to that is sleeping with priests is a strange thing for new mothers to be doing. So, at any rate, we go to 1 Samuel 2, verses 25 through 26, and we'll finish this audio. "If one man sins against another," Eli continues, he's talking to his sons, "God will mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for the Lord desired to put them to death." Now the boy Samuel was growing in stature and in favor both with the Lord and with men. Now, when Eli asks the question, who can intercede for a certain person, it means somebody who sins against God. If you sin against another man, God can mediate. But if you sin against God, who's going to mediate that one? As Adam Clark says, quote, "This was a question of the most solemn importance under the Old Covenant, especially after the death of Moses, the mediator. The law had determined what sins should be punished with death, and it was supposed that there was not any appeal from the decision there pronounced." Remember Nadab and Abihu violating the holiness of the temple, but shacking up and fornicating like in the doorway of the tent of meeting. I mean, that really is pushing it. Now we have a Calvinist Arminian eruption here. These little problems pop up every now and then. It says in verse 25, "They would not listen to the voice of their father, for the Lord desired," or "because the Lord desired to put them to death." And that makes it sound like God just arbitrarily has a desire to go pick on Hophni and Phinehas, and he wants to put them to death, so then he makes them not listen to the voice of the father. In other words, the effect is turned around from the cause. Normally we would think somebody doesn't listen to the voice of the father, they sin, and so therefore God desires to put them to death. Now there's a couple of ways you can handle that. Clark, the Armenian, says you just translate that "for" as "therefore." Here's what he says. Quote, "The particle ki, which we translate," and I hope I pronounced that right, it could be chi, it is ki. "The particle ki, which we translate because, and thus make their continuance in sin, the effect of God's determination to destroy them, should be translated therefore, as it means in many parts of the sacred writings." Well, if you translate it that way, that takes care of the problem. But even if you don't translate it that way, there's not a problem either. If you believe that the son's previous sins had brought judicial punishment on them, and as a part of that judicial punishment, a further part of it is that they wouldn't listen to the voice of their father. In other words, their sin produced more sin, produced judgment, and the judgment is more sin. That, of course, comes up a lot when you're talking about the hardness of Pharaoh's heart. The reason his heart was hardened was because he sinned, and then when he sinned, as a part of his punishment, he sinned some more and got harder and harder and harder. So I don't think that's a problem here. John Gill, who of course is a Calvinist, says that punishment follows sin, just like Clark the Arminian says. But in addition, the punishment includes further sin, the further sin being judicial blindness. So if Gill is right, then the sons of Eli sinned, and they're punished for that by being blind. And because they're blind, they don't listen to the voice of their father. Well, I'll leave those deep theological speculations till later, so that we now have time to proceed in our next audio to 1 Samuel 2, verses 27 through 36, And there we will see the Lord rejecting Eli's house. We'll take that up next time. I hope you enjoyed this audio.